Well, Wilma, if we agree with him, if we agree with him, he's courageous, and if we disagree, he's stubborn. It's about that simple. It's a fine line between integrity and stubbornness. It's a very fine line. The same strength which gives you integrity can produce stubbornness too.
Well, I'm glad you said that, because I was complaining that I didn't see anything parallel.
It's a strong person, and it's a matter. It's relative. It's just like, you can prostitute creative imagination by rationalizing. That's merely the abuse of creativity. In other words, you use your creativity to justify yourself instead of facing a problem and saying, mea culpa, stop being a damn fool and go and do better, you know? Now, going back to this challenge, it to me is the keystone of what this book is about in many ways. Each human being has been given a certain amount of power. We, into our custody, has been given a little control over the circumstances of life. We have a mind. We have freedom of choice in all essentials. Not complete freedom of choice, but complete freedom of choice concerning this essential. We can use our mind to the best of our ability, or we can wrap it in a napkin and bury it in the earth of neglect. And I suspect that's not a very good way to make the grade. But if we do use this mind, then how do we use it? What goals and purposes do we espouse? In the using of this mind, we develop strength. I don't think the universe is too interested in weaklings. As Jesus said in indignation to the 12, when they came back and said, Master, the Greeks won't take us seriously. They say this is a fine religion for theoretical weaklings. And Jesus got up and he kept indignant. He says, do I look like a weakling? Did John look like a weakling? Are you weaklings? No, Jesus was the epitome of strength, held in almost perfect leash. But I don't think he ever once exerted his strength on his own behalf. Once or twice he used his strength to protect someone. I'm talking about physical strength. Jesus never even used his intellectual powers to be clever.
That's
what I'm saying. To hogtie anybody. Once or twice, he hoist a questioner on his own petard. When they, in effect, asked him, had he stopped beating his associates, he was clever in his answers. And they said, Master, by whose authority do you do all this teaching? He said, I'd like to ask you a question first. By whose authority did John baptize? And then, of course, they couldn't answer that question, and he didn't have to answer their question, because there was no good answer. Jesus never used his physical strength or his mental powers unfairly. He talked to people at their level. All of his power, all of his strength, and believe me, just as a human being, this individual had commanding strength. He never used this except for a good objective. When you stop and think of what he did on Palm Sunday, here's a walled city. The combination College of Cardinals, Senate, and Board of Aldermen, which was the Sanhedrin. They run that city, pretty much, subject to the Romans. They said, look, this is an undesirable character, we're going to do him in. And he wants to get in there and teach one last time. And consider what a masterful psychologist he was. How did he handle that situation? In such a way that they were afraid to touch him. This is what he could do when he wanted to do something. This man could manipulate multitudes if he wanted to. He did on this occasion. He bought 3 days' time for teaching purposes. But how many times did he use his full human powers for anything except his Father's will? This is power, real power, subordinated to spiritual guidance. And yet, all during his lifetime, and up to his baptism, I think we can draw heavily on his life for human inspiration. What a tremendous guy he was. As a man among men. But again, he never took advantage of people. When he was talking to Ezra, the backslidden Jew, he didn't throw his vocabulary at him as he did to the philosopher in Athens, you remember? Which caused the Athenian to say, at last I've met a Jew who can talk something besides theology and believe something besides racial egotism.
Type of mind, would you say Michael
Hyams? Jesus? Michael or Jesus?
Which? Michael. Because Jesus would have 7 adjective minds during the
soul. Michael has mind because the mind of a creator son is reflectable over the reflectivity circuit. So he's got mind. I suspect he's got mind as a direct endowment from the third source and center. And I repeat, I suspect the book is silent on this point. This is not creature mind. This is creator mind.
It might be something more than cosmic mind than what you think.
In potential, yes. In manifestation, I'm not sure. A creator son is hard to classify. A creator son, in potential, is much more than a finite being. In function, he's finite in the present universe age. In function, in observable function, I think Michael's mind is finite. Now, what goes on in the secret recesses of Michael's consciousness, it would be folly to speculate. But I suspect there's much more than finite function going on. Here it speaks of a conclave of creator sons, master sons, 150,000 of them, debating on the prospects of the master universe. They're collaborating with the architects of the master universe. They're not working on the finite level.
You think he may have tied into a new circuit after his seventh
door? I don't know, Burke. I think it did some things to him. After his seventh bestowal, he took an oath not to do anything new or radical in the creatorship line. And I suspect that's because certain, perhaps superfinite creator prerogatives were liberated by this bestowal. And it was important that he not function on these levels in the present universe age. And I suspect this is held in deferment for possible function in outer space. In the next universe age. And if he couldn't have done something that wouldn't fit, then why did they require that oath of him? If something hadn't suddenly become possible.
Well, do you think rather than a new type, he probably had some liberated, some portion of his mind perhaps liberated that had up to that moment been dormant? that was liberated by experience?
I don't know. I don't know.
But you could guess.
Well,
I mean,
they say that each creator son is the absolute of the joint concept of the universal father and the eternal son which gave him origin. And that word absolute is an awfully big word. Now this would be absolute not in the universal sense. This would be absolute in a qualified sense. He would not be absolute in universality, but this would have nothing, this wouldn't in any way impair the quality of absoluteness. It would merely limit the quantity of absoluteness. Now, how much of this Michael knew from the moment of his appearance, and how much of it is a discovery to him as the little growing boy, Jesus, gradually discovered the nature of Michael? I don't know, Bert. I just don't know. By either speculation, he either knows from the beginning, or it is a progressive consciousness. Or, you see, we're talking about a creator now, and we're creatures. Or there are levels of consciousness in Michael, as well as in these creative associates. And he may choose to operate on different levels, even as Jesus, in his public career, sometimes chose to be limited by the knowledge of a human being, and sometimes chose to make available to himself Michael's information.
He could have various dimensions too.
That's why I don't want to answer your question, yes or no. I think it's more complex than we realize. And maybe the answer is both yes and no. Yes. God has levels of consciousness. The Universal Father, on the absonite level, knows the end from the beginning. Now, what he's like as an absolute deity, I give up. Because the terms omnipotent, omniscient, and omnipresent are defined as absonite qualities of deity, not absolute. At the same time, I think the Universal Father has a finite experience. As the bona fide father of each of his creature children. And I don't think on the finite level he knows the end from the beginning. And God is real on the finite level just as much as he's real on the absonite level and he's real on the absolute level. I think God can adventure on the finite level. I do not see how he can adventure on superfine levels. Here you have the whole question of the reconciliation of free will and predestination. And as the papers point out, foreknowledge is in no sense an abrogation of free will. It merely indicates consciousness outside of time, as well as an adventure within time. Those are good questions, Bert, and I don't know
now,
the answer.
Now, Bill, you would come nearer knowing the type of mind that the creative spirit, has, because she would have the type of the third dimension.
But I think that's where Michael gets his mind too. All mind comes directly or indirectly from the third dimension center. If Michael has mind, he didn't get it from the Father or the Son, because they don't bestow mind.
But the divine minister is a vocalization.
Yes. So I think Michael's mind comes from the third source and center too, else it would not be reflectable. Were that the case, then you would not have the voices of the Creator Son, which is one of the orders of the primary second of him in the Super Universe Reflectivity Service. Michael would be as opaque as a thought adjuster. And I'm sure neither the Universal Father nor the Eternal Son gives him mind because they have none to give. They can give him spirit nature of a creative status, and the Father can give him personality. But it must be the third source who gives him mind.
It wouldn't necessarily be the same type of mind.
No. I don't see why it would have to be. But it has the same source. And again, it's the mind of a creator, and that must be qualitatively different than the mind of a creature. At the same time, contactable, just as the personality of a creator is contactable to the personality of a creator. Creature personnel, yes. All you need is the perceptive equipment to know you're there and to recognize the Creator. And we will someday have that equipment on Salvington. And we'll meet Michael of Nebadon. And we'll know who he is. And there will be a mutuality of understanding. Ours will be limited by our capacity. His will be relatively unlimited. But there will be contact and communication and a measure of understanding on our part.
While we're here.
And at least we will certainly get the full flavor of the humanity in Michael. This will come through loud and clear. There are three aspects of his character. They're human. He got them on his last three bestowals. This will really register. He'll have a very, part of him will have a feeling of that wholeness.
That's another reason that anything that he had while he's here, he has it now.
Sure he does. Sure he does.
Now while we're here, do you mind telling us a little about how the mind of a supreme being will unify or correlate the Almighty Supreme and God the Supreme and the Supreme Being, or how that will be, how that will work?
The mind of the Supreme Being right now would appear to be focalized in Majestan. That doesn't mean that Majestan is the possessor of the mind of the Supreme, but rather that Majestan is the... Well, let's read the text. Let's see what it says here. The factualizing mind of the Supreme as a time-space experience in Majestan. This mind of the Supreme is bestowed by the conjoined actor upon the Supreme Being. The papers make a very interesting speculation that the solitary messengers may be a creative repercussion of that bestowal of Supreme Mind. And I wish we knew just a little more, because I think the speculative possibilities there are tremendous, but we know so little that you can't speculate very much. This mind of the Supreme is functional on the pilot world of the outer Havona circuit, and it unifies the converging power of the Almighty with the spirit person of the Supreme. That's one of its present functions. The papers speculate that when reflectivity operates, these reflective personalities are plugging in on the consciousness of the Supreme. And this implies that the consciousness of the Supreme, that the Supreme Being is conscious of the total finite evolutionary creation. This checks with a comparison that's made in one of the papers on the Supreme Being where they liken the Supreme to the living organism of the grand universe. Hence the mindedness of the mind of the Supreme would be present throughout the grand universe. And all mind would be, in a sense, a level of his consciousness, his emerging, evolving consciousness. Always remember, he's unfinished. He is a growing reality, a becoming reality. I think that the consciousness of a local universe mother spirit is correlated with the consciousness of the Supreme. I think the 49 reflective spirits are, in a sense, focal points of intelligence within the consciousness of the Supreme. I think the cosmic mind is a level of the consciousness of the Supreme. Now, there's an odd thing about the mind of the Supreme. His evolutionary growth from the standpoint of almighty power, an experiential spirit personality, is limited, is correlated rather, with the growth of the seven superuniverses. But his mind potential is not thus limited.
Then we're going to scream out his mind.
No, we don't.
We don't.
Not yet. I think there's an interesting parallel. On a planet, there are two growth limits that you can't transcend. One is material, and one is spiritual. There is an end to the development of physical science. Someday, the physicists will bang right up against the functional presence of the master physical controllers, and that's as far as human science is going to go. And you can't transcend the threshold of a just refusion in spiritual growth. That limits the planet spiritually. But there is no limit to intellectual growth on an evolutionary world, no matter how far they're settled in light and life. Because apparently the mind function of the Supreme is not going to be consummated in the grand universe. The papers state that the Supreme Being has three levels of function. He functions primarily in the central universe as a spirit person. Secondarily, in the grand universe, that's all seven superuniverses, as a personality of power. His tertiary function is of master universe scope, and they think it is an unknown mind potential. They also have other speculations about his master universe function, but that's one of two or three speculations. Some new expression of mind.
Is this my science? Would this be my science?
I think supreme ultimate mind. I don't know, Bert. We're getting awful far away from that. I think supreme ultimate mind, oh golly, I would associate that in some ways with something after the full growth of the master universe.
Forget I got out for that song.
And that's more than a jillion years from now, so I'd say we're out of bounds. I would say the infinite spirit reveals the mind of the creator to all creatures. And the mind of the supreme will be a composite revelation of the mind of all creatures to the paradise creator. There's another aspect to the mind of the supreme that pertains to the remote future of our own growth. At some point in our evolution, and I think it's about the time we entered the finality core, there's an aspect of human mind that we lose. And we lose it because we don't need it anymore. It has previously acted as a liaison between the mind of the ascending creature, now a finaliter, and the mindedness of the thought adjuster. And we have evidently grown to the point where this linkage is no longer a requirement. We lose this, and we lose it to the Supreme Being. I think this is a part of his creature inheritance. Later on, we become endowed with a part of his mind. That would be in the seventh stage of spirit being. And this is one of the reasons that we become really his children. This finishes our identification with him. Our whole evolutionary growth has made us like the Supreme. In the same sense that our Orvantan growth makes us like the seventh master spirit. And the thing that all super universes would have in common would be a likeness to the Supreme Being, who is the epitome of evolution. And this is why they tell us that in outer space, finaliters will portray the Supreme Being with the same assurance with which Jesus portrayed the Universal Father, and for the same reason, inheritance. We have evolved into his likeness, hence we are competent to portray him. Jesus was of origin in the Father, hence he could portray him. That's about all I know about the Supreme Mind. But it apparently is its present focal point is Majesta.
But I don't know why it couldn't have a present focal point. That 7, 8, 9, 7, 6, 1, 5.
Yeah, there's an analogy there.
Well.
Yeah. I'd like to ask a question about human mind. Why is it so stubborn?
We all like human mind.
Inherent,
you know, genetically, we sprung from the lemur stock, but psychologically, it would appear to be much more like mules. Why in the devil are we so stubborn? I mean, why is it we get old so soon and smart so late? You know?
That trace is still probably.
I fear you're right. Well, I'm sure it requires redirectionization. I can see the value of tensile strength and courage. And I can see that mulishness is nothing but a misuse of that strength. I guess if a stubborn guy gets on the track, he's awful hard to divert that. I can see value, but it sure is hard to take yourself, for example, and do better.
Well, that can be drawn out. That quality can be drawn out in part to that point of stupidity.
Sure it can. It's like the conservative that said, what's good enough for Pappy is good enough for me. And I said, wouldn't it have been a hell of a position for the 12 apostles to have taken? I mean, there comes a time when you should make a change, you know. Has survival value because it's bred in pretty deep into the human species. We are, after all, the products of the people that survived. And stubbornness must have some value.
Well, it has parts of that value as far as our everyday life is concerned.
Yeah. It's an aspect of courage.
If you didn't have some stubbornness, you would ask the person try a rather complex physical problem.
You'd give up.
That is why you give up.
That's right.
So maybe it's a part of our growth
Well, could it be that what we lack is basically is spirit insight, which would better tell us how to directionize the stubbornness? You see, when you look at Van, he doesn't seem to be at all mulish. He seems to be magnificent because he picked the right side, and you just couldn't budge him. Now, that's not stubbornness now. That's magnificent courage. But how about Nod, who picked the wrong side and wouldn't change? Just to make a comparison.
Yep.
Yeah.
Okay, that's the point of
stupidity. Yeah. I mean, as long as we're talking about Van, let's not overlook Nod. He was the leader of the 60 that followed Caligasti.
So he had charge of industry and trade, you know, he was chairman of that committee.
Van was chief justice. But then you can pick them out down the line too, and they split in various ways, in a not altogether predictable way. And while we're on the subject, I think it's very significant. Each of these 100 corporeal members of Caligasti's staff had no thought adjuster. They were detached, standing by on Jerusalem. Each of these individuals had, as an associate, a modified Amidonite. Or Andonite. Yeah. They called them Amidonites later. And these Andonites were also undying. They've been so equipped. But when you figure out how they chose, a higher proportion of them stuck with them than went with Nod. And I think if I were to guess the reason for the fact that they did better than the Jerusalemites, I would say it's because they had thought adjusted.
Mm-hmm.
And the Jerusalemites didn't. Yeah. I think there were 16 of them that refused to follow their Jerusalemite associates. And they stayed with Van. There's a value. Well, I think this would work out. The adjusters carry weight. They carry weight. Well, if it weren't for a thought adjuster, how could a human being be certain of God? How did he put it?
I can't tell you the word.
Well, I'll just describe the concept.
Well, he made a very intensive, very thorough study of religion. I think his conclusion was that you have to faith is the individual creature. Tried to scientifically, logically, spell out that there is a God, and he was unable to conclude the
can't.
Reason is an element, but you have to say.
That's right. God's not unreasonable, but you can't reason yourself to that conclusion.
Well, wouldn't the Spirit of Truth say something to do with the
only
mysterious God?
Yeah, but the Spirit of Truth comes after
the adjusters. Well, I know it does.
Well, where do you go back before that time? The God of exercised the agent of worship, but they didn't exercise the agent of wisdom.
Yeah.
So they knew there was a supreme power there. They worshiped something.
Yeah.
But they didn't worship it wisely.
Good example, I think, is Andon. He was tempted to worship fire, but decided he controlled fire. So he wound up worshiping the sun. And I would say, as between fire and the sun, he picked a better symbol. It's a more magnificent thing. Now, I call your attention to this fact. Andon technically was the sun worshiper, but Andon survived. The people that adjudicate, I don't think, are too concerned with false symbols. They're concerned with the spiritual intent of the human heart. If we turned out as sun worshippers, but I think that was a step forward for Andon. Sure. We should know better. I think he did very well with what he had.
We might still possibly survive, but we'd have fewer credits.
Yeah, I'd hate to chance it. I'd hate to chance it. This thing to me is, I feel certain enough of God's love to be completely without fear. But I also feel certain enough of the requirements of the Supreme Being to be completely lacking in any feeling of complacency about this thing. I have a feeling of being totally challenged.
You're ever mindful that this is still an evolutionary world?
Sure. I'm mindful, too, of the fact that Jesus did not give the same instructions to the ten at the Lake of Galilee. He spoke about trust and love and obey. I'm mindful that he sent the twins back to their fish nets, and he was pretty persistent with Peter about being a good shepherd. He asked a great deal more of Peter than he asked of the Alpheus twins. I'm mindful of the parable of the talents. The boss man, he didn't entrust each of his vice presidents with an equal amount of money. He gave $5 million to one and $3 million to another and $2 million to another, and he fired the guy that put his $1 million in the safe deposit vault. And he expected proportionate return, but not equal return. One man gained $5 million, another man $3 million, and another man $2 million, and he gave them equal praise because they had done proportionately equally. And how do you know how many talents you have? You know? Are you supposed to come up with $2 million of profit or $5 million? The one thing... That's exactly my point. That's exactly my point. Ma'am? How did you... Yeah, that's right. Who are you? Who are you? The first question they raise in when they look a person over to decide whether he's qualified or not is the significance of origin. This testimony is offered by a secondary seconophant. In other words, who is this character? What did he have on the ball? Well, how many talents did he have? What kind of return can we expect? And then, You remember the next thing that they look at is the memory of mercy testifies. They don't ask us to make it on our own. They make some gifts to us. Remember how they describe it? They say it's a gift of lavish proportions, far in excess of your sincere of your capacity to exhaust if you're sincere. Then the third question they ask is, how much time did this person have? Did he have time to make this investment? I mean, what is this a reasonable thing we're doing? Gee, how fair that is. I symbolize this as a fraction. And I think I would express the denominator in terms of human potential and the numerator in terms of human achievement. And so the thing would always be kept in balance. The greater the potential, the more would be asked. And you take, if the Alpheus twin be taken as, let's say he's a person of one talent, about all he could do would be to love Jesus and be loyal. And the twins loved Jesus and were loyal. All right, that's 1/1. That's good performance. Mm-hmm. Let's say Peter had considerable more on the ball. Let's say Peter had 10 talents. Well, he better produce 10 times as much or he's not going to look as good. And this is fair, isn't it? The boss didn't ask the guy with $2 million to come up with a $5 million profit. He only asked him for $2 million profit. But the man that had the $5 million, he asked for $5 million. And that G's too with his statements about the different expectations of teachers and pupils and of masters and servants and so on.
Well, the very first thing that they checked the origin.
Yes. Significance of origin,
then
the memory of mercy, and then time. Yeah.
Is he a Bantu or is he a something?
No, I think the factor of mercy is in the numerator. And I don't think any of us deliver what we should. That's a free gift to help us balance our books. And I think with the help of that gift, maybe we can come out in balance or close enough so they take a chance on it. He'd been shown, Philip had this stubbornness we're talking about. And can you think of any of the 12 that died more magnificently than Philip? And can you think of any of the 12 that died more magnificently than Philip, whose wife kept on teaching after he died, and died for her pains? And they had a daughter who succeeded them and kept on. So the mere fact of an unspiritual mind, I don't think, is a permanent handicap. I just think it makes a lot of trouble for the time being. But on the other hand, Philip was a very methodical guy. Remember, it says he had to cope with some of Jesus' unexpected demands, not to mention the helter-skelter business methods of some of the other 12. And only, very seldom did he run out of supplies. He was a good quartermaster. to the 12th. Philip, I think, was simply a literalist.
That's what I was going to say. Even during the time he's following Jesus, he probably was most concerned with the material things. And none of the Jesus rubbed up on him until after the resurrection.
He loved Jesus, though, Wilma. I think the crucial attitude in a human being is one of love. If man loves God, then I do not think that any human limitation can keep that man from finding God. And the reason I'm so sure of this is because I'm very sure that God loves man. And if the creature loves the Creator, and that love is reciprocated, then nothing in the universe could keep the creature from finding the Creator. And without that love, I don't think any aptitudes or qualities could ever make it. Judas was a fairly smart guy. He's a good businessman. Along with Nathaniel, had the best education in the 12. And I'm always glad that one other fellow had a pretty good education, because otherwise it would seem to be a liability. And the one difference between Judas and the 12, I think, was love. There wasn't anything Judas was up to except at the very end that others had participated in. He was never alone in his shenanigans during Jesus' public ministry. No, I don't.
Today was you.
I have no right to that statement. Because in making it, I sit in judgment on Judas, and I have no right to sit in judgment on him, but you asked me for an opinion, and that's my flat opinion. I don't think he did. I don't think survival is universal, Wilma. I think it's optional. I don't think you can be statistical on this. I think mathematics breaks down.
But not all.
I don't think everybody that wakes up on the first mansion world continues to survive. Because I think they, in any case of doubt, they always give the creature the benefit of the doubt. And as Jesus said, if you're uncertain about the seed, plant it. See what comes up. Sure it is. And on the finite level, I do not think this is predictable. Now, I think you can make books, and I suspect that statistically you'll come out all right, but I don't think you dare bet on any one individual. You can be an actuary, but not a prophet. I think if you take, let's say survival is optional. I think if you start out with basic gene pattern and quality, I think you could come up with some statistics. At least the life carriers in these papers are continually screaming at us because we don't pay more attention to this. And I'm sure they have a reason for this. And I'm sure their reasons are not completely temporal and planetary. But I think it would be utter folly to try to say, this one or that one. Wilma, I don't think you'd want to. Survive. I don't think Judas would want him. He didn't want to live. He proved that.
Well, Calligansky was a feminist, was given a choice.
Yeah.
All the means he did, he was given a choice.
Maybe he was given a chance. I don't know.
I think Jesus personally gave him many chances in the last many chances that we call.
There's a limit to mercy, and Jesus proved it. And Jesus proved it when, at the Last Supper, in essence, he told Judas, get lost, friend. Or in the biblical word, Judas, that which you have in mind to do. Go now and do it quickly.
But coming around the other side, there were many reasons. Perhaps that Judas was the chosen one to be what he did.
Who chose him?
Where'd you get the word chosen?
Maybe I shouldn't use the word chosen.
I don't think anybody chose Judas to do what he did. I think Judas elected that. I think Jesus had great qualms about Judas. I don't think Jesus had any illusions about him. And what's more, Jesus didn't recruit him. He was recruited by one of the first six apostles. Yes, Jesus recruited the first six. The first six chose the second six. Jesus accepted him. And this was a faith adventure on Jesus' part. I think Jesus, from a human standpoint, had grave misgivings about Judas. But he didn't raise any questions. He accepted. I don't think anybody elected Judas to do this, except Judas. Judas was a dirty dealer. You come right down to it. Judas was a rat, deserting what he felt was a sinking ship. He wanted to be a senator, a cardinal senator in the Commonwealth of Israel. That's what membership in the Sanhedrin was roughly equivalent to. It was a combined religious and political body. And since he didn't think it was going to mean much to be an apostle, he thought he'd get the best he could on the other side of the fence. Judas just didn't love Jesus. Well, that's all I can see. He wasn't the only one that wanted to make him king at the time of the feeding of the 5,000. He had good company. It was Peter that got the sword. I think he took one. Almost everything that the apostles were up to during Jesus' public ministry, Judas was never the only one involved, except at the very end.
The evening before the resurrection, all the apostles faced Judas. Believed that Jesus was more than the Son of Man.
Yes, I think probably this became a doctrine with them after the pause on the road when Jesus said to Peter, but who do you say that I am?
And Peter jumped up
to his face. And Peter blurted out 50% truth and 50% error. He said, you are the Messiah, error, the Son of the living God, truth. And how human. You see, it was this belief which beclouded their realization of what was coming. And that, we have just one statement in here which gives you a feeling for how they looked at him. Page 1786. paragraph 2. This is the summary of the final discussions which Nathaniel and Thomas had with Rodin, and they are discussing the divine nature of Jesus. And these are their reasons for believing in his divinity. He possesses a superhuman consciousness of the presence of deity. He prays like a man, but performs like a god. He seems to foreknow things. He even now dares to speak about his death, some mystic reference to his future glorification. You see, this is how they interpreted it. And this is why the 12 were completely unprepared for his actual death. They were sublimating this. If he was divine, then he couldn't die. The two statements were inconsistent. So they rationalized it. All of Jesus' statements, flat statements about going up to Jerusalem and dying, some mystic reference to his future glorification. The only one that took him literally was good old literal-minded David Zebedee, the head of the FBI. No.
Just from them.
Joseph, mm-hmm. That's what I meant.
That's the only statement in all part 4, I think, which revealed the attitude which the apostles had.
Well, I found a couple more references.
You did?
Yes, sir. And I'll tell you, I was looking for them on account of there was a slight disagreement with one member of our group. And on page 1716 and on page 1746 and 1747, I found things that would lead me to believe that...
1716?
Did you disagree on that too?
I don't know what you're
going to talk about. 1716 doesn't have much on it.
Well, that's, you've got to glean pretty close there. Somebody's been through the wheat field on this sheet.
Mm-hmm.
What is the proof found on 1716?
I'm not looking on that page. I'm looking on something else.
Well, while you're looking, I will reassure Mary Catherine. Mary Catherine, you worry about why he doesn't have another chance, or another chance, or another chance. On 1974, Jesus made one last effort. And this, he's walking down the trail now in front of the soldiers. Jesus made one last effort to save you. Actually betraying him, in that before the traitor could reach him, he stepped to one side and addressing the foremost soldier on the left, captain of the Roman, said, "Who do you see?" That's what Jesus meant. Immediately he stepped forward and said, "I am he." He tried again to save him.
Save him from
betraying him.
Didn't say to save him.
He
said save him from betraying him.
Well, why didn't they give him another chance? He's had
many. I don't think it's our job to decide whether Jesus survived or not. I have the opinion, and I won't defend it. I just have the opinion.
That's the only thing that makes you think that he may have had no chance at all. I'm open-minded.
Yeah.
If aren't you shut the show down, and
well, I'm not shutting anything down. Just go right ahead.
Well, you said, well, Bill, I've got two things.
No, I just said I had two references. Just take them down, look them up, and get home. You know, read.
Well, were they for Bill or Clyde?
Clyde.
Why'd you give them to me after class? Continue, Bill.
Don't think we ought to quit at 5:00.
What time shall we reconvene? Reconvene. Reconvene.
When do you say, Archbishop?
Oh,
it's like 7, so we can figure out.
Let's make it 7 and make it a short evening. That's
right.
2 hours. How's that?
Good. Be all fine, Dandy.
7 it shall be. Okay, Jamie.
It's me.
7 bell.
Now, all of you, all of you are invited to come to my house in honor of the Elder Law today, if I can come, hold up your hand. That is good. I'm the one that
came. Beverly. Can you make
Beverly?
Ah, well, in T-Town B, I am sorry. You have liquid moisture on your boat.
Unspiritual.
Well, now,
do we know? Sure, because he went on preaching the gospel in the end.
Well,
you can prove it.
The resurrection may have been the...
Philip always wanted to be shown.
Ms. McManus, I wish you'd take these references.
I did, darling.
I don't think... Here, many times in the papers here, they use English in a common way, which means rather loosely. Burke and I were talking about their use of the term 3 days. I don't interpret that as a literal period of 72 Urantia hours. Jesus was resurrected on the third day. That was happened to be the third calendar day, but 36 hours later. A Melchizedek, if he errs in judgment, retires from active function for 3 days, but on the third period. And then again, they don't say whose days. Are these Satania days, Salvington days, or Urantia days? I think the expression stems from the old Jewish belief, which may have been shared by others, that when you buried a person, after the third day, they were real dead. The ghost might linger for a little while. And I think this is because too many times they buried people like the widow's son at Nain, and the next thing you know, somebody's banging on the tomb from the inside. And this would give plenty of credence to the fact that the ghost was hanging around. Because, you know, the medical profession would never admit they'd made an error in diagnosis. They'd say the guy was dead and came back. The doctors can't get by with that today. And I think that the term 3 days, the third day, the third period, means a relatively short time, but an appreciable length of time. It's not a few minutes. Now, when they say there are just so many Creator sons, I think that's a very precise statement. When Jesus says that Philip's mind is unspiritual, I think he is speaking relatively, not absolutely.
Well, maybe not absolutely.
Yeah. Less spiritual than many.
But dead is Cajun dead.
That's real dead. Yeah.
How do you spell that, Cajun?
B-H-A-U-N.
That's Louisiana Cajun.
That's Cajun.
Yeah, I think if you try to be legalistic in the meanings you attach to certain terms in here, I think you live in trouble. And you have a perpetual problem of interpretation. Right.
We go from where we are to a question. I have no picture. Jesus is on the cross. He looks down and he says, woman, behold your son. He lifts his eyes, his son, behold your son. Whom was he speaking? Both of them. And what was the connotation of those?
I think he's merely saying, Mary, Mother Mary, look to John for what I would do for you.
Right.
And to John,
take care of my mother.
Please treat my mother as if she were yours.
Miss Grisho,
that's why Miss Grisho and Wilma and Miss Elliott. I wanted reassurance.
That would be my feeling of what he meant. Like,
I like that too.
I like it too. I like it very much.
Because
very comforting.
But John was Jesus.
Not blood brothers. Not his blood.
No.
No,
John was the
son, you mean? Son or brother?
Are you talking to John Zebedee?
He's talking to John Zebedee.
Yes. Yes.
John Zebedee,
this
interpretation would be consistent with the unique relationship which John Zebedee sustained to Jesus.
Jesus
had
been with him.
Jesus, yes. Jesus had entrusted John with all his surplus earnings. In German, called Gestalt. There is no English for Gestalt. There's a word gemütlich in German, for which there is no English word. The word Gestalt is in Webster's dictionary now, because the psychologists have brought it into the language. Jacques Weiss told me of a number of technical difficulties he had in translating this book into French. For a literal translation would be gibberish in French. You've got to sacrifice the literalness of the translation for the meaning. In French, we have three pronouns, for example. In German, you have three genders in declension. In French, you have only two. Everything is either le or la. In German, it's der, die, or das. You have masculine, feminine, and neuter arguments. In English, you have no distinction.
We have you, she, and it.
Yes, we have pronouns. Let's get out of here before all our time goes away. We're working on overtime.
Well, I think you finally wound me up on that. Judas and so forth.
I don't know.
What happened to Trump? Did he have to
do it? I don't know what happened to Judas. I just have a feeling. I'd like to talk to you a little bit about people in the Urantia book. Would you be in the market for some ideas? All kinds of ideas have been expressed about this book. And I've had various ideas from time to time. I find myself very radical in comparison to the do-nothing type of thinking. And then when they want to take a full-page ad in Life magazine, I find myself very conservative. And I don't know just what I am about, what to do about this book. Jesus didn't stand by passively and say to the 12, we will spend our time in prayer and meditation, and this will make us so attractive to our Jewish comrades that they will flock to us in multitudes. He did tell them to do things. He admonished them that if they really wanted to carry his credentials, there was only one type of credit card that would operate, and that was they had to love men like he loved them. And I don't know that he particularly restricted those credentials to those 12 people. I sort of figured that he was talking to the world in general and to the ages to come as well as then. I think a person today has a perfect right to aspire to try to love people the way Jesus loved them. I don't know that we're going to do too good a job of it, but I don't see anything to stop us from trying to do that. And I think if you want to work for the boss, this would be one way of getting off on the right foot. I've spent a long time with this book, and I've thought many things about it. And I've thought many things about the people that have read it. Not all of them have been 100% complimentary from time to time. I've been guilty of sitting in judgment on people. I make that as a rueful confession and not as anything I've ever been proud of. I think somewhere in between beating a drum, getting up on a soapbox, draping a sheet over oneself, and holding up a placard which says, "Jesus saves, read it in the Urantia book," and doing nothing except thinking benign thoughts, somewhere in between those two extremes would lie common sense action. Do you see what I'm trying to portray? I've got a very frustrated old-time buddy who's out in San Francisco. He's a consultant like I am. He's an advertising consultant. And he wanted a real promotional job done on this book. He wanted some ads run and really get behind it and push. You know, like advertisements in the Saturday Review of Literature, and I've seen ads in there about, you know, my 7 minutes in eternity by the man who came back, and that's a dignified magazine. And I think my friend is frustrated. We have a friend in common in Dallas, and my buddy sent him a book. And our common friend is general manager of a grocery chain. And I don't think he knows I have any connection with this book. And he's kind of mad at my buddy because he made a merchandising recommendation that cost him around $600,000. And I guess you don't like people that cost you that kind of money. And one night he was kind of unburdening himself, and he said, "Why?" He says, "You know, that old boy sent me a book, some crazy book about religion. And then," he said, "he had the nerve to ask me for $10 for it." And I was so mad at him, sent him $10. Well, of course, that dates the book because the price went up shortly thereafter. I never sent this man a book because I didn't appraise him as a person who was interested or in the market for the book. I see a copy of this book, which my buddy sent out. He sent about 100 Urantia books out on publication. It sits in an office that I was using this last week. This is the office of the chairman of the board of the company I was working for. It sits in his office because it's a pretty book with a blue binding, and my friend, the board chairman, is a converted Roman Catholic. I think my advertising buddy is a disappointed human being. He tried so hard. And he sent so many books out. And he got turned down on all his recommendations for big ads and promotions and whatnot. I dare say that you folks here in Oklahoma City are conversant with people who want to move this book in a big hurry. Perhaps even people that use the radio for such purposes. And you're also conversant with a school of thought which comes awfully close to saying, do nothing. Just sit and be good and be so darn sweet that you'll kind of be like, you know, like molasses is to the flies. and they'll just come to you. I can't personally, and I'm speaking just for my own personal feelings. I'm speaking for nobody but me. I can't personally subscribe to either of those concepts. I think the business of attracting people to you by the obvious spiritual virtue of your life is wonderful. It's idealistic. But I observe that when Jesus was trying to get something going, Jesus was a very practical person. And he had to deal with ordinary, everyday folks. Folks just like we are. And he didn't tell the 12 to become so spiritually attractive that the whole earth would be overcome with their virtue. He gave them some rather specific instructions. First of all, he said, it'd be an awfully good idea if you developed a new kind of fatherly affection for people. That's much more than brotherly affection. And then he said, do something about this. And he sort of encouraged each one to do what he could do. And he warned them against the darn foolishness which he feared they might engage in, such as he told James to stay alive, and of course James went off and got himself killed pretty quickly. He didn't ask the Alpheus twins to feed his sheep, and he did ask Peter to do that. I've alternated between hope and frustration for 6 years, 5.5 years since this book was published. I never expected too much, and I never expected nothing. And what has actually happened has been very much better than I feared. And a little bit less than my minimal hopes. I have a feeling that, to use the scriptural form, we be few and the labor be many. And I don't feel a bit frenzied about this, frustrated, or in danger of working up a sweat. This is not an altar call that you're listening to right now. It's just adding up the score. Clyde was saying last evening that he felt the need to kind of consolidate his position on this book before he went out and tried to propagate it. Ed Jones was saying, now that I know more about it, I'm not giving as many away as when I didn't know so much about it. Well, let's go back to the story of the sower. You can throw an awful lot of seed on barren ground or on shallow ground. And I'm sure this builds your arm muscles, and you get a lot of practice sowing, but it doesn't reap a very substantial harvest. And I dare say that, well, to take Ed, we talk about Ed because he isn't here. He can't defend himself. I imagine that when Ed does sow seeds from here on out, he's going to have a much higher yield than he had on some of his earlier sowing. I think Clyde's feeling, and since Clyde is a full archbishop, we can discuss him without fear of embarrassment. Isn't that right, Archie? Now, if he goes around calling himself Card, he hadn't got any red hat. That's coming later, see? I think your judgment is probably darn good. You feel the need. All right, satisfied. I wouldn't try to do any missionary work until you feel the assurance which you now feel the need of. I've increasingly come to this position, because after all, there's only one person I can do much about, and that's me. And I'd just like to share my thinking with you. I think, first of all, we take care of our health and then our duty. But I do think the Urantia book then comes ahead of the trifles of life. It ranks number 3 in my category. I've done a darn thing about this book for about 3 months. Well, that's like I've been to see you folks. That's all I've done. I haven't opened it up until this morning. Because my friend, the Internal Revenue Department, expects me to do my full financial duty for the Treasury Department, and I've been engaged in diligently discharging that duty. I've tried to look at the present position of the book, where we are, and what can be done with who we are and what we have. And I feel that it is wise to attempt to take advantage of every reasonable thing that comes along. I don't feel disposed to go out and manufacture opportunity. But I try to keep my radar turned on all the time so that I'll register opportunity when it comes upon me. I'm not going to Tom, Dick, or Harry with the Urantia book, but I'm very quick to respond to any discussions of a religious nature. Now, I'm giving out fewer Urantia books than I did 2 years ago. I think if we are alert to possibility, we have patience, but this is not the patience of either indifference or slothfulness. You can confuse patience and slothfulness, I think. Awful easy to say, well, I'm conservative, I'm going to be patient. I'm going to give the angels of progress and the angels of the churches and the spirit of truth and the Holy Spirit and the thought adjusters plenty of chance to work on this. But if that was enough, then what are we standing around for? And why bother with the Urantia book at all? Because all of these influences have been here for a long time, and they're operating here regardless of the Urantia book. If you could be patiently alert, if you could be conservatively diligent, if you could be cautiously courageous, if you could be enthusiastic with good judgment. I can't duplicate the parallels they use in the papers where they talk about the character of Jesus. Remember those wonderful couplets they used? He was courageous without being audacious. He was realistic but never prosaic. He was emotional but never flighty. He was generous but never prodigal. There's somewhere in between doing nothing and working up a frenzied perspiration, I think, lies the course of good judgment and effective work. And I think each person should sit down and add up where he is and make a plan for action or make a plan for study. I don't see how you can do a good missionary job on this book until you have a fair grasp of the book. I don't mean that you have to know it thoroughly, but golly, how can you sell a product that you can't even demonstrate or you can't reasonably discuss?
Well, Bill, I've noticed that when we first got it and we read the first section of the book, we was all had a burst of enthusiasm there. We sold these books. I guess ignorance is bliss, but if they learned more about the
Booth and went to explain it, they got themselves into trouble. They get in too deep. Where if you didn't know it, you wouldn't, you see? The people that you meet that haven't had contact with the book, I don't think you have to be much of a student if you've been interested. They understand, because if you go to getting in too deep, you're getting yourself in trouble. That's my experience, see what I mean?
It's important to know what not to get into.
Yeah, that's right. But if you go in too deep in this book, you're just cutting your throat. Now, I had a conversation the other day with a geologist, a young geologist.
And this wasn't Clyde, was it?
No, he's a young fellow. I didn't even know he was a geologist.
Young man.
He's in his middle 30s, this fella.
Are you sure this is
real? Really? Young. I can say young. And I never make myself obnoxious, but it come up about hobbies, and I told him, well, my hobbies was kind of studying the different religions. See, it just sneaked right into
this is a good. This is Jack's or better.
And he opened the door wider, and he says, well, I believe in evolution. He's a geologist, naturally he would. That opened the topic. And we had quite a nice discussion. But his father-in-law is a Nazarene minister. Now, his father-in-law don't believe in evolution. He does believe in evolution. And he used to teach Sunday school out there, but they cut him off because he got into evolution a little bit, see. And I classified him. I didn't think he'd ever make a student of the book. If you could get him interested, he'd be fine, but I didn't think he was interested enough to. I told him all about the book and everything, and he ought to read it, and different aspects, the epics of time that would interest geologists and all of those things, but he didn't respond.
Well, you tried.
Sure.
You tried.
But it didn't make myself obnoxious. It come up natural, you see. Now, that's what I wait for, is a natural. If it could come up natural, then you're all right. And then if you get a spark out of them, why, you can go to work. But don't get into it too deep. Now, I wouldn't endeavor to get in with him other than what his learning
this
was.
This makes sense.
See.
I've got an interesting chap. It's the one book I gave out in the hospital. Tom Archer is this chap's name. He's an unhappy Lutheran. I made sure he was unhappy before I gave him the book. And he made a date to come see me. This would be 2 weeks ago